Hey there, this is Laura Kanoy.
Shh.
What? I mean, what?
Loretta Allison here. We're having a secret drive.
Oh, so that means...
Shh.
Oh, got it. If you love the exchange, consider a small donation to the station that makes it.
Go to nhpr.org/support and chip in, and we'll send you some secret swag.
We're trying to keep things quiet, but we hope you'll make some noise for the exchange.
This podcast of the exchange is sponsored by Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Despite a national economic pickup, small town and rural America got a dose of sober news this month from a report by the Economic Innovation Group. It's an organization that, as the name says, studies innovation, measured by new business formations or startups. And its recent report finds that increasingly, innovation is geographically concentrated, leaving out large segments of the country. For example, in this post-recession recovery period, just 20 counties generated a whopping half of all new business establishments. For comparison, during the last recovery, 125 counties created half of innovation growth. So what does all this mean for New Hampshire, a largely rural and suburban state? We'll find out today in The Exchange as part of our monthly review of economic headlines. And let's hear from you as we cover this story and more. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Russ Tebow, president of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consulting firm in Laconia. Russ, welcome back. Good to see
you. Thanks.
And also with us, Steve Norton, executive director of the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies. And Steve, good to see you too.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, Steve, I want to start with you. What jumps out from this real interesting study from this innovation group showing that increasingly business innovation is really highly concentrated in a couple metro areas?
Yeah, well, you think about economic development over the last 300 years, there's a resource that's being identified as critical to whatever period we're in. It was rivers, it became mills, and now it's human capital and the interaction of human capital and research and development and idea creation. And that tends to be in places with high density people where you're getting lots of interaction and new engagement and new ideas. So, you know, it makes total sense that, you know, there are parts of California, high density, highly educated individuals that are churning and developing ideas that are spreading out.
And of course, that's always been the case. You know, people have gathered in cities and innovation has come from there. But just looking at the numbers, Steve, wow, even in recent times, like in the 1990s recovery, you know, one in four jobs, for example, new jobs came from rural or small town America. In the 2000s recovery, early 2000s, it was one in five. So, you know, there's some sharing there. Now, this report finds it's one in 10 new jobs comes from small town rural America. So the concentration has rapidly accelerated.
And even more in New Hampshire than elsewhere. I mean, we continue to see population declines in our rural counties. We continue to see a right sizing, if you will, in this new economic world in which we are not extracting resources from our rural areas. And so it's certainly one out of 10 jobs. It's less than that in New Hampshire since the recession have been created in areas outside of New Hampshire's primary cities.
Why do you think it's so fast and so dramatic, Steve, again, from the 90s to the 2000s to now?
Well, I don't think it has been fast. I think it's been a slow, gradual decline from the 1980s, 1990s, 2000s, and slowly but surely that economic development, the center of activity has shifted to the more urban areas in New Hampshire and nationally as well.
What do you think, Russ? Is this surprising?
Somewhat, but I agree with Steve that it's something that's been going on for a long time. If you look overall in New Hampshire,
We have 1,500 fewer businesses in the state now than we did in 2008 when the recession began. And we've lost them in the technology sectors. We have fewer businesses in the technology sectors as well, although the number of jobs in some of those sectors has increased. About 10 years ago, we did a study in Conway for the Mount Washington Valley Technology Center. And I looked nationally to find technology jobs in rural settings, thinking that, well, with the internet, you can be anywhere.
Right.
You know?
Live in a beautiful place, go rock climbing at your lunch break.
You know, sit in your cottage in the woods and connect with people in Palo Alto. The fact of the matter is we didn't find those technology centers in rural settings anywhere. It was Palo Alto. It was Austin, Texas. It was the Denver area. And as Steve said, it's really skilled, technology-skilled employees. Without the employees, you can't attract the establishments, and the establishments won't come without and the people won't come without the establishments. So there's kind of a catch-22. If you don't have the people, you can't get the jobs and businesses. If you don't have the businesses, the people won't come. So it's a very difficult conundrum to bust open for rural
areas. So there's
a areas.
Limit to the idea of a virtual workforce.
Yeah, there really is. Businesses don't want to be in a rural setting where if somebody leaves next month, they have a hard time attracting somebody to move into the area. They want to have somebody just down the street working maybe for a competitor.
I was going to say that we did a story a few months ago about this company that had been in New York City, and they wanted to move to another city area, but they didn't. They just wanted to find some other place where they thought there was a good place to go, and they picked Manchester, actually downtown Manchester. So we did the story about this tech company that's coming to Manchester, and basically their argument was that it was basically what we're talking about. You know, not saying that Manchester is New York City or anything, but they were attracted to the city, to the environment, to I guess you would call it, you know, the ecosystem that's growing in New Hampshire, in Manchester specifically, as opposed to, let's say, you know, Bedford or Londonderry. They're going into the city itself. And that's on a very small point, very small level, what's going on. The Manchester is doing pretty well on the whole. But if you look at the rest of the state, as Russ was saying and Steve, it has been on the decline in terms. But the urban areas themselves, Portsmouth is another great example, and Dover as well.
So it's kind of New Hampshire, you're saying, Jeff, is a microcosm of this national trend that we're seeing.
Absolutely.
Right.
And jobs and innovation are concentrated. Go ahead, Steve.
You know, there are folks out there that try and identify counties that have high innovation possibility. And you know, there are maps that show red spots, which are really intense, entrepreneurial, engaged, churning businesses. And no question, you see Cambridge right there, high up. Well, you run up 93, you see it all the way up through Nashua, all the way up through Manchester, and all the way up the seacoast in New Hampshire. That same intense entrepreneurial capacity exists in at least, you know, 40 miles into the state. So there is good news here also that we're not going to be Silicon Valley, but maybe we might be the stepchild of Silicon Valley or whatever
the beloved cousin.
But unfortunately, all of us here are old enough to remember when we used to talk about the Golden Triangle, which was Manchester, Ports, you know, Seacoast, Manchester, Nashua, and, you know, Salem and that whole area. And that was basically because we were getting the spillover from Boston. You know, we had these huge, you know, we had Apollo Computer, Digital came in, all these big employers. And I guess that's what we do in New Hampshire, is keep our fingers crossed that Boston does really well.
Yeah, I think a lot of that was also manufacturing, you know, rather than the true innovation. Maybe the innovation was happening in Cambridge and the production was happening in New Hampshire to a degree. And once the production shifted to China and to Texas and Silicon Valley, we kind of got left in the wake, I think, to a great degree. So,
and in New Hampshire, all of this is intimately linked to the development of human capital. Because if you look at a map of New Hampshire and you look at high innovation spots, you see right up 89 that place called Hanover, which has a lot of business churn, which is generally a healthy thing, a lot of new engagement and ideas, and as well as Manchester and these other places. So to the extent that we are capable in creating or bringing people in, the better off we'll be in this entrepreneurial innovation environment.
The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Today in Exchange, a roundup of economic news. We're going to look at several key indicators and their impact on the Granite State. We'll look at inflation and consumer debt. But right now we're focusing on a new report that finds that business innovations, startups in this country are highly concentrated in just a couple areas, about 20 counties. We're looking at what that might mean for us in the Granite State, as we're hearing it's not all bad news, given that Boston is one of the places that was found to be highly innovative. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. I want to pick up on something Jeff said. And Jeff, you used the word ecosystem. And this report talks about the entrepreneur ecosystem. So what does that look like? Jeff, I'll turn to you first. What's an entrepreneur ecosystem?
Well, it's basically it's an area where that includes ways, includes universities, you know, colleges, young people. It has it encourages some kind of equity investment mechanism around there. It has the housing stock that's attractive. It has the basic infrastructure, but it also, the most important thing, it has to have the employees. That's the most important thing, and that's one of the concerns. That's the main concern of so many people in the New Hampshire tech community. That's why that big argument about people are so desperate, basically, to try to attract workers. That's why this whole idea about the rail has become such a big deal in that part of the state, because they think that could attract younger workers as well. But basically, what it is it's this infrastructure that's supportive. That there's a critical mass of companies like that there already. It's like my father used to own a business in the Garment Center in New York, and that's what that was. It was a Garment Center ecosystem. There were hundreds of thousands of people employed in a few blocks in New York. You know, all these businesses were near each other, the button makers and the dressmakers and all this other stuff.
So you could buy your buttons from that guy and your thread
and you just walked out. And it was all just walking in.
And if somebody quit, you had ready,
absolutely
trained,
absolutely
skilled people standing by to
yeah.
fill that
I mean,
job.
That's, it's basically that idea, except in the 21st century.
Russ.
I think also there's sort of the creative part of the economy is important to that subsector, having creative amenities, the arts, culture, a lot of more young people, cool bars to go to at night. Because a lot of the entrepreneurial spirit is young, okay? It's probably under age 30 where a lot of the energy is coming from. And when you're under age 30, and we know that millennials are a little later to hook up finally for their long-term relationship, this whole milieu of I'll live in a small apartment, but I want to have a lot of things around me to go to. So I think that a place like the Seacoast offers that. Downtown Manchester, to a greater degree than it had been the
yes.
case, offers that. Hanover, Lebanon offers that. So I think that the demographics are also important.
What about capital, access to capital, Russ? I mean, how important is that to this entrepreneurial ecosystem? Venture capital, but also just, you know, old-fashioned bank loans.
I think that a lot of young businesses start on credit cards. I have a son that started a business. He did it on a credit card with a 23%
really?
Interest rate to
start.
Didn't
even bother going
off.
Through a bank.
It was just difficult. It's very difficult to get, say, a $50,000 loan when you're, you know, basically driving a 5-year-old Toyota. So you don't have the assets to support the loan. And the Small Business Administration provides support for small loans. But I think by and large, a true startup, maybe mom and dad help out, credit card helps out, your friends help out, and then you get to the next level where you get to that point where you're looking for an investor once you've demonstrated the viability of your concept. But I think initially you're starting very small and almost a garage-type deal.
Yeah, go ahead, Steve, and then Jeff.
Yeah.
I would say just also it's – we got to make sure we don't compare ourselves to Silicon Valley or to Boston. We're not going to be those two communities. We don't have the infrastructure for it. We're too far away from markets. We don't have 16 universities in one spot.
Well, and Silicon Valley traffic is
unbelievable.
Not something
that's
that
right.
I would want to be yeah. in. So,
and not
yeah.
to mention housing costs.
Right, exactly.
But if you look at venture capital per capita, so the amount of money that's coming into the state relative to the size of the state, we're in the top 10 in the country.
In terms of venture capital?
Yeah. I mean,
New Hampshire?
It's small. It's small compared to Massachusetts, one-tenth the size of the money that's going into those ventures in Massachusetts. But it's still a good deal is going in, and it's because we have these ecosystems, because we have the Lebanon, because we have the aerospace engineering in Dover and Portsmouth, because we have the emerging high-tech environment that's growing up around Dyne in Manchester. So we're not all that in a rough situation. We're doing pretty well for our size and our relative location. Compare us to Vermont, compare us to Maine, the other northern New England states, and we look like we have the most entrepreneurial, fastest growing, you know, economy in the Northeast.
Well, that's interesting because I have read that in addition to this business innovation being heavily concentrated, that venture capital is even more intensely concentrated. So that's good to hear, Steve. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, this is a topic we discussed, I think, the last time we were here, is that that's why it's so critical to talk about the demographics of the state, because we do have these ecosystems, but what we need to do is have the employees, the workers there. And that's one of the things we're really trying or we hope we're trying to address that need, because our aging workforce is a major is a hindrance to the future growth of the state, and that's why that should be the number one issue right now when we're talking about it, especially during the gubernatorial races.
I think one of the resources we have is we do have a lot of workers here in the state that work in Massachusetts that may prefer to not deal with that commute. So perhaps that's something that we could do a better job of making apparent to potential businesses, that there's I think it's around 100,000 people commute. So,
do you want to jump in real quick, Steve?
Yeah, well, I'd just say we also can't forget rural New Hampshire. There is an ecosystem that's emerging now around places like Littleton and Bethlehem, not so much in the far reaches of the north because the population is tending to come south and west, but that is something we need to be watchful of as well. There are still lifestyle businesses that are emerging up in the north country, and we need to just keep that on the radar.
Well, yeah, and in a few minutes, maybe we should talk about that. We've talked a lot about the Dovers and the Portsmouths and the Hanovers, but we should talk about those other areas and what this information means for them. But, gentlemen, let's go to our listeners, too. Again, the exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, it's our monthly economic roundup. We're looking at some of the top economic headlines around the country, how they affect us here in New Hampshire, and let's hear from you, especially as we talk right now about this idea of business innovation, startups, where they are concentrated. And guys, let's go first to Nashua, and Chris is on the air. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
So I'm a high-tech professional. I work for a San Mateo-based, you know, Silicon Valley-based company with an office in Boston. The only reason I'm here in southern New Hampshire, which I love, by the way, is because there's the access to Boston if I need to go in on the charter bus that they offer. But that is a painful experience because it takes like easily 2 hours in the midst of heavy rush hour. So I'm just saying that it's, you know, it's there, but it's not great. And if there was a more reliable rail service, I think that would help to expedite, you know, the flow of talent back and forth and make southern New Hampshire, the entire southern tier, be even more attractive to talent. So that's the first thing I wanted to say. The second thing I wanted to say is I think it's interesting how so many businesses, you know, are opening up offices in these innovation clusters, these areas, which also happen to be really high tech, you know, high tech locations like Boston, New York, and Silicon and California, because they have to be near the talent. They'll pay to get near the talent, and that talent lives there because of the institution, because of the infrastructure, like I mentioned, because of the amenities. And so I feel like politicians who talk about tax cutting as the panacea to everything, you know, two tax cuts and call me in the morning, I think they're being very short-sighted and
well,
they're
Chris,
not investing.
Good to hear from you. And Russ, do you want to jump in there? We've already talked about the rail, but go ahead.
Yeah, I think that Chris raises a good point, and that's the linkage between southern New Hampshire and Boston and Cambridge has been critical to the state's economy forever, since I moved back, which was 40 years ago. This has been critical, but the dynamics of it have changed. The nature of the linkage now is more commuting base and a back and forth movement across the border. As I said, there's like 100,000 people, I think, that leave the state every morning and come back in the evening. And a lot of these people are like Chris. They're technology based. They're young. They like living in New Hampshire. We offer a good lifestyle, more affordable housing. I'm looking at some housing units, two-bedroom units in the North Shore that are $2,700 a month in a conventional garden apartment complex. It's getting quite expensive to live there. So what we may see this time, instead of firms moving over the border, we may see people like Chris moving over the border, and that will be the resource that we can build on.
Well, it does show just how important that human capital is. And as he said, Jeff, companies are willing to pay the high prices to be in those high expense areas like New York if they can get the right people.
Yeah, and that is the main argument of the High Tech Council and the chambers down in the southern parts of the state about that rail. They think that, as Chris was saying, that's something that could attract people to live in the state if it's easy to get to Boston. And then if you have them living in New Hampshire, then maybe some business will come because they know the people are there.
Well, gentlemen, coming up, we should definitely talk about what this concentration in innovation and startups means for non-metro areas. And you alluded to that, Steve Norton. So we will follow up in just a moment. We'll also talk about all the speculation as to whether the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at economic headlines, including the latest on inflation and the possibility of higher interest rates. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Russ Thibault, President of Applied Economic Research in Laconia, Steve Norton, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies, and Jeff Feingold, Editor of New Hampshire Business Review. And gentlemen, before we turn to those other topics, inflation, interest rates, consumer debt. Let's finish up this conversation on this new research showing that increasingly business innovation is concentrated in a couple areas. And Steve, I'll turn to you first. You mentioned that there's some good news in this study for Dover, Hanover, Nashua, Manchester, Portsmouth, maybe Concord. What about the other places? New Hampshire is still largely a rural state.
Well, it actually, from a geographic perspective, is, but from a people perspective, it's not. We've seen, continued declines in population, over 5% decline in population between 2010 and 2015 in Coos County. So the question is, what's happening to that area? And it's downsizing, and the nature of the products that they're producing is really changing. It's now a place where people go to be a gateway to the North Country. It's a place where people go to have lifestyle businesses. They might be high tech, they might be manufacturing, but they're going to be small, and they're going to be there because someone really wants to be outside of the metropolitan area. That's the new ecology of the North Country, and it's still changing. We're still moving away from the extraction base to this new concept of rural ecology, economic ecology.
Yeah, Russ, I think we are seeing vitality north of Concord in the Lakes region and the Mount Washington Valley around Lincoln in terms of second home, vacation home living. And I think people are spending a little bit more time there. But it's been kind of slow during the recession. But before the recession, I remember I counted up, we were working on nearly 1,500 housing units north of Concord, proposed vacation housing units. That has changed, but it's coming back slowly. And I think that's part of the North Country and the rural area of the state. I think it's what Steve's talking about. It's more lifestyle rather than employment-based. I think tourism, second homes, hiking, skiing, boating, all of those things help to support southern New Hampshire as well.
Yeah, but I have to say, though, when you look at it, it's been over the last 30 years or so, there's been this really dramatic decline in the evaporation basically of the paper and pulp industry, which was such a vital component of the North Country. You think of the city of Berlin, it's hard to think of it now, but it was a wealthy city. It was people with really good jobs, and there were thousands of them, and it's the North Country is going through an emotional change as well. I mean, because lifestyle idea. It's not the way even people today who remember what it used to be like. It's a very difficult thing to go through.
And it's not a failure of the North Country.
It's not happening at all.
Across the country. This is, to some extent, the North Country and New Hampshire held off this change for a little bit longer than some of the rest of the resource-based economies.
Yeah. Let's take some calls, gentlemen. Again, the number for you to join us as we look at some of the top economic headlines of the past couple weeks, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And in Bow, Victor is calling in. Hi, Victor. Go ahead, you're in the exchange.
Hi.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if I could actually hear the panel talk about the access to infrastructure, especially as the farther north you get in the state, you seem to have less access to things like high-speed internet, and even FedEx delivery times start to get later and later in the day. This posed a problem for me. I have a video production company. We were trying to set up office in Littleton, and the internet speeds just were not where we needed them to be, so we wound up in the capital area.
Really? Wow. So you wanted to be in Littleton and be part of that, North Country revival, Victor, but it just didn't work for you.
It didn't work. It wasn't where we needed to be and everything, so we wound up settling down in the capital area, and where the internet speeds were better, but still, it's not where I'd love them to be and everything. We have satellite offices in California and in Texas. Their internet speeds are twice what we've got.
Well, Victor, it's good to hear from you. And I want to let you know also that Lucy in Greenfield sent us an email on the same line. She said, please ask your guests how large a role the lack of high-speed internet may play in discouraging tech businesses outside of the Route 93, 95, and 89 corridors. So that's from Lucy, too. I have to say, Steve Norton, I'm kind of shocked by this, that in this day and age, 2016, slow internet access is still holding people like Victor back.
Well, Victor still has internet speed access that's 100 times what it was 10 years ago. The question is the relative speed, relative to southern New Hampshire, relative to, the area around MIT and Boston. It's like any infrastructure. Why have we not made a decision as a state to do rail? Because Nashua and Manchester, to a lesser extent, will be the ones that benefit the most, but we're asking the entire state to pay for it, and the entire state does not want to pay for it, and therefore we do not have rail. So same thing for rural areas. What's the return on investment to the state from extending that high-speed internet, all those other infrastructure components to the more rural parts of the state? It might be the right thing to do, but it's probably not the best use of scarce resources.
I think there's economies of scale. When the density of users is too sparse, you end up having the cost per user being prohibitive.
Yeah. But I do, as far as I know there are states and other regions that are making that public investment. I think Vermont is an example of that, where they're being more aggressively trying to increase the broadband to residents. And it'll be interesting to see if Vermont succeeds, how that would play out in terms of maybe attracting some people that might have been going to the North Country, New Hampshire, going to Vermont instead.
There are some parts of the state where there's no cell phone access, and it used to be fairly common. Driving down Route 106, you'd hit dead spots and whatnot. It's gotten better, but there's still a lot of the state, when you get north of the Lakes region, that you're not going to get to use a cell phone.
And a lot of young people are cell phone only. They don't want landline.
They don't want to talk to anybody. They just want to be on the cell phone.
It's part of the ecosystem we're talking about. I mean, if you don't have that kind of infrastructure, it's going to be difficult.
The entrepreneur ecosystem, again, that this report talks about. JC from Manchester sent an email on this. He says, the New Hampshire business model favors our politicians and business leaders courting outside industries and corporations instead of creating conditions for upstarts and homegrown innovations and entrepreneurs. JC says even in the cities of the state, Manchester and Nashua, tend to create barriers to local business people. What do you think, Jeff Feingold, that the business model has been more, let's get that big company from out of state to move in, instead of encouraging, again, this entrepreneurial ecosystem?
I think that they're in a lot of ways that's kind of correct, but that's one certain strategy the state has followed forever, which is basically poaching. And most states, they poach businesses from other places and try to bring them in here. But I do know that many, many cities, many regions are trying really hard to make it easier for businesses. There's a great example that's happening right now in Concord, where they're going to have an economic development director, and they're going to want to work to get their economic development up. They're working to make it easier for people to start businesses, to own businesses. And that's been true in a lot of other places in the state. The unfortunate thing is that when it comes to actual construction of things, that's really one of the barriers to businesses, because there are so many things like planning and zoning ordinances and all that stuff that really have prevented certain kinds of businesses from actually building things. And that maybe that's one of the barriers he's talking about. But in terms of starting up businesses, usually it's in most places in the state, it's usually a pretty simple process compared to some other places.
JC, thanks for the email. Russ?
Yeah, there have been a lot of attempts with incubator buildings around the state in various areas, in Manchester, in the Mill Yard, in the Seacoast area. There's one that has started up in Plymouth that's funded by the Grafton County Economic Development Group. And they have a kind of spotty history. It's been tough to make them work. So I think that you know, the survival rate of a new business venture is fairly low. There's still a lot of failures before you hit the right thing. And I think it's been difficult to support the kind of innovation centers where you might have mutual support, a great copier down the hall, a conference room down the hall, good internet access, good telephone service, or somebody can just slip into a small office and have the supporting services right there on the same floor. It's been tough to do. So I think that there is innovation that's going on. We do have incubator buildings, but it's been a difficult road.
I have to say, some of those incubators have been very successful, like the one in Manchester, Alpha Loft, and also there's one the one up in at the Dartmouth area. But that's another example of where those are much more vibrant economies for that kind of thing.
Steve,
I think the study also begs a pretty tough question, and that is, as a state, are we going to invest to the exclusion of other places with less entrepreneurial activity and innovation in our little hubs that we have and build on them? So is the legislature going to take a look at Manchester and the set of levers that they have and focus on Manchester because it is this opportunity for economic development? Are they going to focus on Nashua on the seacoast? I mean, we have for a long time had a North Country plan strategy. We've not had necessarily an entrepreneurial ecological approach to economic development in the southern part of the state.
That's a really interesting question. And maybe we'll pick that up next month when we cover the economic headlines, because that is really interesting. Are we going to do it that way based on this new research, or are we going to try to serve all masters, so to speak? Let's take another call, gentlemen. This is Dave in Henniker. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, good morning.
Morning.
About 15 years ago, New Hampshire had the highest percentage. Excuse me, I got a speakerphone. New Hampshire had the highest percentage of employees in the tech sector of any state in the country. And know the next year after that, it slipped because Colorado grew even more. I was just wondering if you know, anyone on the panel knows, what percentage of our employees are in the tech sector now, and how does that rank nationally? It seems to me that we're still a very attractive place to live, and we're just as close to Boston as we've been, if not closer. And there is expansion of the internet in various places. And I should think that at least in the southern tier, this would still be the case.
Yeah, Dave, I'm
very
glad you called.
Place to live.
I remember those numbers a long time ago, at least 10, if not 15 years ago. And then we kind of slipped in terms of the percentage of high-tech workers in our workforce. Steve, right. Do you know where
still,
we're at now?
Still twice the national average. We're still
okay.
You know, way up there. We're not Massachusetts, but we're still, they use something called a location quotient to identify those occupations or industries where we have a significantly higher share than you would expect. We're always way up there in the tech sectors.
There you go, Dave. And again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. This hour on The Exchange, it's a roundup of New Hampshire economic news. You can join us with your comments, questions, personal experiences, 1-800-892-6477. So, guys, we have a lot of other subjects to cover. Couple big numbers that I did want to make sure we got to today. And Russ, I'm going to turn to you first. Interest rates. Every time the Federal Reserve gets ready to meet, you know what I'm going to say. There's all this speculation about whether the Fed will raise interest rates or not. Before you get into that, will they or won't they, Russ, just remind us, how does the Federal Reserve, you know, wave its magic wand and say, interest rates, you are now higher?
Well, they control the money supply, basically. So they can pour more money into the system, which would lower interest rates, or they can pull money out of the system, which would raise interest rates.
Because it's a scarcity.
Yeah. They don't, like, order and say the interest rate will be 0.5%, but they, by virtue of being able to, in effect, control the money supply, they can have a significant influence on interest rates. And also,
so if they tighten up, interest rates go up because money
right.
is scarcer.
Right. And they have a dual, basically a dual purpose. One is to keep the economy growing at a reasonable rate, which is they think is around 2.5%. And the other is to keep inflation at a reasonable rate, which is around 2%. So they have that dual mandate is what they refer to. Lately, in December, they raised interest rates a quarter of a point, and with little impact on the economy that is perceptible. At that time, they said they expected to raise rates four times in 2016.
That sounds like a lot, Russ.
That is a lot. But they really have their finger on the trigger. They want it, my interpretation is they want to get interest rates into a more normal range. They are still exceptionally low historically right now. So I think what they're looking at, if you look at inflation, there's still kind of cross currents going. In the first quarter, right after our last meeting, growth in the U.S. economy was only 0.5%, which is disappointing, well below their target. And I would suggest they shouldn't raise interest rates because growth isn't fast enough to meet their target. On the other hand, this month, just last week, the inflation figure was released, and it was up higher than it has been in 3 years. So that suggests that they can raise rates. So my personal feeling is they want to do it. They got their finger on the trigger. This inflation figure of rising at about 1.6% by annually at their measure. Energy costs are going up. That will add to more impetus to inflation. I think they're going to take another notch in the gun barrel in June.
And they'll do it in June. It's interesting because I was reading a lot on this last week, Russ, and a lot of people were saying, yes, yes, they're going to raise rates. And then this week, a bunch of people, you know, on the financial news networks and stuff said, no, 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 they're going to wait. So
right. It's kind of a fun game. It's kind of like who's going to win the World Series. The Chicago Cubs are in first place. Are they going to be able to hang on to the end of the year? Who knows, you know? So you can debate it. But it seems to me this inflation number is really telling and will give them the rationale, the excuse to move interest rates up, which is what they really want to do.
But,
Go ahead, Jeff. But then again,
that really weak GDP number is the thing that I think is making them a little more concerned. We had the president of the Boston Federal Reserve was in Concord earlier this month, and he gave a somewhat hopeful picture of the economy, but it wasn't like the most it wasn't like it was a robust thing. And he was trying to just read between the lines. And I think you really do feel like what Russ is saying, that they really would like to raise it, the interest rate. But, you know, what do you do if it's the wrong decision?
Well,
you know,
that's
if it's at the wrong time.
So, right. And the economic growth, as you said, Russ, was disappointing last quarter. So isn't there a fear, Jeff, that if you raise interest rates, you're going to slow the economy down by making borrowing more expensive and depressing some of that innovation that
well,
says
I
want.
Think the most obvious thing is the real estate market in New Hampshire. You know, that'll make it a little harder for people to buy houses. Although, as Russ said, these are such historically low rates. You know, how does that affect, how will that affect the buyer?
It's a quarter of a percentage point.
What
I find fascinating about this time period is I think that no one really knows what's happening, and that what the Fed is really trying to do ultimately is get back onto ground that is firm and not completely regulated by their actions. Right now, every time the Fed gets together or huddles, the stock market plummets.
Right?
No, back in 1913 when Woodrow Wilson created the Federal Reserve Bank, that was not his intent.
No.
Okay,
well,
nor is it, I think, their intent now. And so I think they're trying to get to a point where they're less driving the economy. And that's just my perspective, and I think they will do it in June.
They're we depend too much on them for economic signals, and we should just decide.
And that makes sense because we're in a historic period. We had the Great Recession, nothing like it since, you know, everyone's still trying to figure out what is the new economy look like. We've got a very different demographic profile than we did 25 years ago. Economic growth is going to be lower than it was, and I think everyone's just tiptoeing around this.
Well,
I was just going to say, the other thing I was going to say about the interest rates is that because they're so low, by raising them, at least it gives some kind of tool if and when we reach another slowdown, which we will. And now, right now, they can't do anything. I mean, I guess they can go what they do in Japan. They have negative interest rates, which is horrific idea. So right now, that's one of the best arguments for raising the rates, so they can eventually lower them again if they need to.
The other thing about low interest rates, they're great for borrowers. But the fear, I think, at the Fed, too, is that if you have artificially low interest rates or where you're really keeping interest rates low in an attempt to increase growth, that you run the risk of asset bubbles that can burst. The stock market has really moved a lot since 2007, 2008. Housing prices have essentially fully recovered. So if interest rates are low, it encourages more borrowing, and it discourages savings, conventional savings. So you have a lot of retirees that have CDs earning 0.15% right now. So there's kind of winners and losers in a low interest rate environment, just as there are in a higher interest rate
environment. Even though low interest rates, people hear it and go, wow, that sounds great. I want to talk about borrowing after a short break, because there's some new numbers on credit card debt nearing $1 trillion. We'll follow up in just a minute. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's a roundup of economic news, including rising credit card debt, the possibility of higher interest rates, and some people looking at inflation going up. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. We're looking at some of these economic indicators and how they might play out in the New Hampshire economy. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And gentlemen, I did want to turn to credit card debt and share with you a couple headlines from the Wall Street Journal that caught my eye this week. Here's the first one. U.S. credit card balances are on track to hit $1 trillion this year as banks aggressively push their plastic and consumers grow more comfortable carrying debt. First of all, Russ Thiebaud, just real broadly, is that concerning? Is it good? People are outspending. Maybe that helps the economy, but maybe they're going overboard. What do you make of that?
It's phenomenal. The amount of the growth in consumer credit outstanding is phenomenal. It's at an absolute record level during the past several years since the recession. And it's helped to fuel the economic recovery. So that's a good part of it. The question is, you know, we need to have the economy stay strong in order to pay that back. And I think that on balance, the rate of growth in consumer credit is really phenomenal. It's off the chart virtually.
Phenomenal in a good way or a bad way?
Both. It's good in the sense that
you're a true economist on the one hand, on the other hand.
Yeah, that's right. The other hand. But people are buying cars. People are buying furniture. People are expanding their houses. People are buying new houses. People are cashing in some of the equity in their house to spend money. And two-thirds of the economy is consumer spending. So that's been a major plus for this economy. And it's probably okay now, given
to have
the kind
all this credit card debt?
Having relatively high credit card levels, debt levels overall for consumers is probably not a bad thing right now because the economy is on pretty good footing. The question becomes, if we do dip into another recession, that could prove to be a problem.
So what's too much? Go ahead, Steve. I'd love your thoughts, too.
Yeah, so, you know, let's take debt in its entirety. Most of the debt is around housing. Right. And people and we've seen, you know, growth in New Hampshire. That's a result of low interest rates. And that has historically driven our exit out of a recession. And it seems to be doing that this time as well. Where we're seeing a huge increase is in auto loans. And that's what economists will say is pent up demand. No one bought a car back in 2008, in part because the recession came along, but also because gas prices were so high. And and we're seeing a bit of an increase also in student loans. But that could be considered a leverage asset that they're, you know, during this recession, people didn't go into work. They went into more school. And now that's going to pay off in the future. So most of the debt seems to be pretty good.
Good. So there's good debt and bad debt.
There's good debt and bad debt.
So good debt is investment debt, education, house.
That's right. The question about credit card debt is it's a very small share of of debt relative to all debt. So what does that mean? And I don't know. I don't know the answer. But if it is actually folks that are spending beyond their means, you don't want to finance that off in the future.
A lot of them are sweeteners too. No interest for a year. But then when that year ends and you've got $7,000 or $8,000 and you're starting to pay 18, 20, 22% interest. Yeah, I think you have to be careful as a consumer to not get sucked into taking on more debt than you can handle, maybe when things are not quite as buoyant as they are now.
Yeah, well, if you think about it, right after the financial meltdown, a lot of people realized what was going on. They paid down all their debt, and there were a lot of people – and then the banks said, wait a second, this is great money for us because they can charge – they're not charging 0.25% on those things, you know, 13 to 20% still. And it's a big money maker. There have been some rules now that have made it their fees that they were charging, which were very onerous. Those have been reined in a little bit by some legislation that was passed during the post-financial meltdown. And it's something that, you know, I think consumers are kind of like feeling getting in the water, obviously, a little bit, much more easily because of these fee decreases and controls.
The cards also have become more attractive, not just, you know, frequent flyer miles, which has been around for a long time, but now you can get cash back with some of these credit cards. So you're encouraged to put stuff on your credit card because you get 1% or 2%. I even read about 5%. Cash back. So again, I keep asking it so simply, Russ, but is this good or not?
I think that initially, going back to what Jeff said, right at during the recession, consumer debt plummeted. People said, I'm afraid I'm going to pay some of this stuff off. I don't want to get caught hanging with this stuff. But immediately, once things started to get better, kaboom, right back onto the train of more and more debt. So I think that the point is that you made yourself, Laura, is there's a difference between, in effect, investment, buying hard goods, a new house, a new car, a student education, and just consumption, using your credit card, building up credit to go out and eat in restaurants instead of maybe eating at home and building it up in terms of pure consumption. Not so smart. In terms of investment, yeah, but maybe there's cheaper ways to do it. Credit card debt is the most expensive debt you can take on.
So right. Those interest rates are still high compared
they are
to
very
what you
high.
Get. But as you said, it's sometimes hard for people to get loans. So,
I just want to say one other thing that we're talking about the banks. You know, these credit card debts are put into asset-backed securities, which I think people will remember from back in 2008. And that could be a concern when you think about this massive amount and whether people can actually meet their obligations of paying these back in the future. Because we went through this when it came to the housing market, and if it's the credit card market, you know, it's the same idea. It's the same theme on, but you know, maybe just a different.
Yeah, when times are good, you can handle it as a consumer. But when times are bad, that becomes pretty burdensome. At 18 or 22 or 25% interest rate. It's very burdensome.
That is a lot. That is a lot. Well, here's the other headline from the Wall Street Journal on this, guys, that I want to ask you about, relating to this boom in credit card debt. The Wall Street Journal says the boom has been driven by steady economic conditions and an improving job market, which all of you mentioned, that have made credit-worthy consumers less reluctant to take on debt. In addition, the journal says, lenders have signed up millions of subprime consumers who previously weren't able to get credit. So that's sounding, Steve Norton, a little bit like Back to the Future and extending loans to people who maybe don't have the capacity to pay them back.
Right. So what to Russ's point, the question is this creating an asset bubble in some way? And, you know, three-quarters of debt is for mortgages. And of the increase, you know, less than 20% of the increase in debt is associated with credit cards. Is that bad or good? I think it's still too early to tell.
Hmm. I think that depends on your circumstances. I think it's just something like it's like a hot potato. Be careful. you may have to drop it. And you want to be in a position where you can handle it if things do head south. I think as consumers, you have to be careful. We are all flooded with promotions for zero interest rates and change your balance, write a check now for $1,500 and you don't have to pay us anything for a year. Yeah. And so it's very enticing.
Again, the number for you to join us on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're wrapping up some of the top economic headlines this hour and how they might affect us here in the Granite State. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Here's an email from Alan that just came in. Kind of relates to something that either you, Steve, or you, Russ, said a moment ago. Alan says, I don't get Wall Street's obsession/fear over slightly higher interest rates. I've been trading stocks since August of 1982, which is when the markets took off from Dow 800 with rates at 15%. Wow, 15%. And for most of the next 30 years, with the Dow rising from 800 to the current stratosphere, rates were generally in the 4-8% range. So again, it's this, is Wall Street, I think Steve, you said this, is Wall Street obsessed with these interest rates and what Janet Yellen and the Fed Board of Governors might do?
Yeah, I think it's reflecting a broader concern about uncertainty. You know, we just don't know what's going to happen. People are concerned about whether we're ending the business cycle. They don't know what's going to happen when we increase rates. And so they focus on what they can, which is, very small marginal differences in the market have big impacts for some of the big firms, and that's what they pay attention to.
And Russ, I have one more Econ 101 question
okay.
for you. So what is the link between the higher interest rates that could be coming down the line and the inflation that you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, I think that the linkage is that as inflation increases, people look for a higher return in interest rates. And so if inflation's at 4% and you're lending money at 1%, or you know, you're basically losing money. You're losing buying power. So interest rates very often are a reflection of inflation rates. And so as inflation increases, lenders and investors look for higher and higher rates of return, which is higher and higher interest rates. So in a nutshell, as inflation rises, you expect to see interest rates rise as well. As interest rates rise, if it gets out of control, it's a damper on economic growth. So
no
maybe
one wants
the
to
core
take out a
thing,
loan to start that business.
Right. The core thing is the inflation rate. You know, I think right now that's the thing I'm watching most closely is if we continue to see rising inflation. We probably will because energy prices are rising and energy is part of almost everything you buy.
Although energy's been so cheap.
It's been so cheap, but it is rising now. I think you're looking at, what, $2.20 a gallon for gas instead of $1.70, $1.80.
Which
so,
compared to a couple years ago, you would say $2.20, you crazy? You know,
right.
That's rock bottom.
But it's the change that matters.
Sure, because it was $1.80, you know,
yeah,
not that long ago.
It's the change that matters. So I think that's sort of the link. Inflation affects interest rates. Interest rates affect economic growth. And so the kind of the start of this whole process is inflation.
Well, and Russ, I know you have to go a little early today.
A little bit.
To an important economic meeting.
Yes.
Meeting with the Fed Board of Governors.
Yes,
probably,
that's
no
right.
Doubt.
Yes. They called me in to ask whether they should do it in June or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, you go tell them what you think is best. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank
we
you
really
so much. And
it.
Jeff and Steve, thank you. Great to be here. Thank you.
That's Russ Thiebaud, president of Applied Economic Research. And Jeff Feingold, I could see you want to jump in there.
I just wanted to say you mentioned from Alan, I think it was Alan's
Our emailer from Durham.
About talking about 1982 with 15% interest rates. Well, that was the depths of one of the worst recessions we've had after the Great Depression until, of course, the most recent one. And those interest rates were a absolute damper on economic growth. And that's when we had the Fed chairman at the time, Paul Volcker, was famous for basically squeezing out the inflation from the economy. And eventually he kept raising interest rates. They were even higher than that by 83, I believe. And he was just trying to bring that inflation down. And it was really a very it was a trying time. I remember I bought my first house in 1983, and I believe the interest rate was about 14% because we got some kind of great deal because we were first-time home buyers.
14%.
And people were saying, what a great deal, 14%. How did you get that?
Okay, that's incredible.
Yeah, and so that we're not talking – well, it's probably a long time ago. You know, I'm an old-timer, but you know, it still wasn't that long ago, 1983.
Okay, so I have another Econ 101 question. Russ is gone, so I got to – throw to one of you guys, maybe you, Steve. What is the connection between possibly higher interest rates, higher inflation, and the U.S. dollar? We're always watching that in New Hampshire. A strong dollar, you know, means our goods cost more. Our manufacturers can't sell abroad. Those Canadians who love to come down and play on Hampton Beach don't come as much. So we're watching the dollar.
Well, there are always winners and losers. And so if you're getting a higher rate of return on investments in some way in the United States and using the U.S. dollar, then the value of the dollar goes up, and that creates a problem for exports. And, you know, so there are always winners and losers in these, you know, measures that go up and down.
So the connection there.
Yes. Yeah, so when we have higher interest rates in this country – and they'll probably, if they do get higher than most other countries, you know, people will be investing in U.S. you know, treasury bonds and all these other things. So it brings in more, it makes the dollar even stronger because it becomes a much more. It's always a safer haven, but it makes it even more of an attractive haven for investors from overseas.
So higher interest rates mean a higher dollar.
For the most part,
lots of things go into you know, the value of the dollar.
But it's all being relative. You know, it would mean that eventually because interest rates are so low around the rest of the world.
Well, partly I'm asking because I'm going to Canada later this summer, so I don't know how I'm going to fare.
Right. I'll tell you right now, you'll get a good deal over there.
Really?
Right now I know it is because it used to be on par with this dollar just not too long ago. Now it's about 75 cents or so.
That's right.
Okay, well, here's an email that came in earlier from Karen in Concord. This gets back to our conversation, gentlemen, about entrepreneurial ecosystems, where they are in New Hampshire and where they aren't. Karen asks, what about the fact that in-state college tuition in New Hampshire is the highest in the nation or so? Karen says that's an important factor in attracting or keeping young people and thus talent that your guests are speaking about. Steve, I know this is a big issue that you've looked at.
Yep. So they're, you know, across all the possible public policy investments that we can make, that is one, and it's an important one. But I think we have to have that conversation amidst all the policy levers. Is it rail? Is it lowering business taxes? Is it lowering college tuition? Which is going to bring us the highest return on investment? If our goal is to keep high level of human capital in the state of New Hampshire, we have lots of different ways of doing it, and we don't do a very good job of allocating resources between those high return and those low return.
So if you had sort of a line of policy levers, Steve,
that's right,
which, you know, let's say you have 10, you don't have unlimited resources, so which one do you yank?
Right.
And trigger and hope to get the best return on investment, as you
said. I think the legislature is starting to think along these lines. Representative Neil Kirk, working with Eric Herr, have put together a report about the fact that we need to build conversations about demographic change into the lifeblood of legislative action here in the state now in a way we haven't had to in the past because we had an influx of highly educated people.
And then during the recession, we were just coping and dealing.
That's
can't
right.
think strategically, big picture, long term when you're just scrambling to fill the holes.
Jeff. And this is also an issue that's very much tied to the flight of younger people out of the state because they do go look for – they go to schools elsewhere. Because UNH and other state schools are higher by comparison to other schools, to schools elsewhere. And, you know, then once they leave, they don't come back. And that's a major concern, which is why I think, as Steve was saying, this is a major policy discussion that is just starting to be held in Concord. And I think it's not too late, but they're pretty late on this. And they really need to start thinking about this kind of stuff.
But let's put it in concrete examples. Do we want to widen 993? Do we want to create rail? Do we want to put $100 million into our university system? Or do we want to create housing that works? I mean, what are the very specific things that we're going to do?
Absolutely. But I'm talking about the whole discussion is just starting to be held when we should have been discussing this
20 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
exactly.
Better late than never.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, guys, I always like to close out by asking you what economic trends or numbers you're going to be watching over the next month or if you've got any reports, Steve, coming out or Jeff Feingold. So, Steve, just give us a little preview of what you're going to be looking at over the next couple
weeks.
We're
going to wait for the Fed to make their decision about interest rates. That's pretty much all we're going to think. But we're working right now because the economy and all that we're talking about has a big impact on the state and state revenues. We're working with the legislature now to think about what does next year look like from a revenue perspective? How are we going to think about budgeting and these policy levers that we're engaging in? So that's what we're working on. How does this economic situation translate into revenues and into decision making in the future?
So which one do you pull and which one do you say not now? Jeff, how about you? What are you working on?
In June, we do our semi-annual check on the economic pulse of the state. We call it the mid-year review. And we'll be start doing the reporting very shortly. We'll be talking to business people in all different sectors, talk to economists like Russ and people like that and Steve, and just kind of get an idea where they think the economy is and how we're doing.
Oh, wow. Well, we'll look forward to that then and talk about that the next time. Thank you very much for being here, both of you. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Laura.
The conversation always continues online as well at Facebook and at nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on NHPR.